Hi there, and welcome to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. Happy Halloween, everyone. Halloween, thought to be rooted in the Gaelic harvest festival Samhain, is seen as a time for ghosts, ghouls, and all things terrifying. Contemporary celebrations of Halloween often include trick-or-treating, costume parties, visiting haunted houses, watching horror films, and of course, telling scary ghost stories. But some of these activities are not limited to October 31st. Horror movies fill movie theaters all year round, and vampires and zombies are pervasive in popular culture. Where does this enjoyment in scaring ourselves come from? Dr. Elizabeth Way, visiting assistant professor of English at Wake Forest University, talks with me about Gothic literature and how the elements of this genre have influenced the literature and popular culture of today. Dr. Way specializes in British Romanticism and women's gender and sexuality studies, and teaches courses in British and world literature, the Gothic, and science fiction. She holds graduate degrees in English from the University of Georgia and the University of Durham in England, where she spent a year as a Rotary International Ambassadorial Scholar. She also holds a graduate certificate in Women's and Gender Studies from the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She has published on Mary Seacole, contributed book reviews for Gothic Studies and Romanticism, and is serving as the invited editor for the forthcoming entry on Seacole in 19th Century Literature Criticism. Her current book project, Romantic Compositions, A Poetics of Home and Exile in Women's Writing, 1789 to 1832, is a formalist and cultural study of how gender and genre inflect portrayals of home and exile in texts by Romantic women writers. Thanks so much for being here with me today to talk about the Gothic.
Sure.
So to start off, could you talk a little bit about when and where Gothic literature comes into fashion, and who are some of the authors that might be associated, also some of the works that would be associated with this kind of writing?
Sure, absolutely, yes. So the Gothic first comes into fashion in England in the 18th century. The first self-proclaimed Gothic novel, The Castle of Otranto, was actually initially published anonymously in 1764, and only in the second edition in 1765 did Horace Walpole actually reveal himself to be the author. He kind of wanted to see if people were going to like it first. So other writers and works that we sometimes associate with the Gothic, Matthew Lewis's The Monk and Anne Radcliffe's The Mysteries of Udolpho, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and then later into the 19th century, we have Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, Edgar Allan Poe's short stories like The Fall of the House of Usher, Robert Louis Stevenson's novella, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Bram Stoker's Dracula. And you know, all of these are fiction writers, but there's also a tremendous amount of Gothic poetry out there by writers like William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, John Keats, Sir Walter Scott, Edgar Allan Poe, and Emily Dickinson. My favorite two Gothic poems, I have to say, are Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner and Keats's The Eve of St. Agnes.
Well, I think about all of the fiction writers and poets sort of coming together and, you know, working on some of this. Like, how much truth is there to the story of the sort of ghost storytelling, you know, with
the haunted summer and the Shelleys?
Yeah.
Well, like every good Gothic backstory, partially.
Yeah. Sure, okay, good. Yeah.
So Mary Godwin at the time eloped with a married Percy Shelley. They joined up with Lord Byron and his eye doctor, John Polidori, at the Villa Diodati in June in 1816 in Geneva, and the weather was pretty foul, and so they had been reading German ghost stories and decided that, you know, non-egotistical writers that they were,
of
they
course.
Were going to have a ghost story contest. In the first edition to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, she tells the story, or actually it's the 1831 edition, she tells the story of having a nightmare, of seeing a scientist hovering over this monstrous creation, and she felt like if she could write a story that would horrify her readers as much as that dream had horrified her, then she would do it. And that's where it got started. Kind of another story related to that is that as a 9-year-old child, Mary Shelley hid with her stepsister, Claire Claremont, in the living room of the Godwins' home when Samuel Coleridge came over to recite The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, because they knew if they were caught there, they'd be sent upstairs directly. Well, they were discovered, but Coleridge intervened and begged to let them stay, and so they got to stay. And so that poem haunted Mary Shelley ever after, and it appears in Frankenstein and everything. So
that's fantastic. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So in particular, what, you know, with thinking about the British Romantic writers in particular, what is it about the Gothic that appealed to them?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things. There was a shift in thinking about what Gothic meant in the 18th century, rather than just being seen as barbaric, vulgar, lower class. It really began to see the Gothic as an embraceable British past. It was a time, literarily, when folk ballads were coming back into favor, and so they really began to see Gothic history as kind of this essential British history, something they could embrace, a source of power, medieval poetry, and they saw that writers like Chaucer and Shakespeare and Milton had embraced these kinds of elements, and so it wasn't a complete non-literary route to go, and I think just trying to embrace sort of the history of the people. Now, the other thing I will say is that it was sort of kind of a collateral damage of the French Revolution. Once Robespierre's Reign of Terror had gone on in 1793, it really pushed writers, I think, to new extremes of imaginative violence. They sought really to make their works compete with these real-life horrors, and they were asking questions like, what were the capabilities of man? What were his imagination's powers, and how did they work? And so, linked to that, they would often use these natural landscapes or settings kind of as a prompt to interior musings about the human mind, and the Gothic certainly afforded a means of doing this, howsoever dark those findings might be.
Mm-hmm. So, what makes a story or a poem Gothic?
Okay, well, lots of what you would expect.
Sure.
And I brought along a copy of a piece by an anonymous author in 1798 who contributed this recipe for the Gothic. So here it goes.
Yeah.
Take an old castle, half of it ruinous, a long gallery with a great many doors, some secret ones, three murdered bodies quite fresh, as many skeletons in chests and presses, an old woman hanging by the neck with her throat cut, assassins and desperados quant sufficient, noises, whispers, and groans three score at least. Mix them all together in the form of three volumes to be taken at the watering places before bed. So kind of what you would expect. Castles, ruins, monasteries. Usually you've got a virginal maiden, sometimes a femme fatale, tyrannical male villain who's trying to undo her reputation. Dark enclosures, passageways, certainly supernatural events, ghosts, sometimes family secrets and crimes that are trying to be hidden. Dreams, stormy and dark weather, gloom. Basically anything that invokes horror and terror, just your typical nightmare.
Yeah. So what is it about this that, you know, what is it about the Gothic specifically that is pleasurably terrifying? Why is that so important to this idea of, you know, the Gothic, and why we like being scared?
Right. I mean, this is really the key to the life and the afterlife of the Gothic. Witness all of the attendance at horror flicks today, right? If you go into any bookstore, they're selling like millions off the shelves. Well, Edmund Burke, he was an 18th century British philosopher statesman, and he described the sublime being that quality which, it was a force which so entirely filled man's mind that he was not able to reason on anything else or consider anything else. It was so all-encompassing. And so, linked with this sense of excess cultivated by this all-powerful event and the fear of one's own self-extinction, Burke really felt that in encountering this sublime, that one could still find pleasure in this when experienced at a safe distance. and so we read about perhaps a terrible avalanche or a physical threat or some kind of unidentified danger on the screen or in books. But we view it or read it safely from our theater seats or our armchairs with our Afghans. this allows us to find pleasure in terror and horror. And so, I mean, little did Burke know that this would be one of the keys to the endurance of the Gothic,
right.
And it still is today.
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely not gone away. So, and, you know, talking further about that, what do you see as some of these some of the lingering influences of the Gothic in contemporary literature and popular culture?
Well, gosh, in so many ways. I mean, I think when you think about the fact that the 19th century spawned the first zombie and the first vampire, and I need not name
exactly
the spinoffs with those. And so I think that while we still have some works that feature some of your typical Gothic trappings, contemporary writers also like to add a new modern twist. Rather than being like locked up in a castle For example, in Stephen King's The Shining, it's a mountainous hotel that becomes the location of mystery and terror. On the other hand, you've also got a short story like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery that offers a seemingly benign rural community on a sunny day, making preparations really to enact a barbarous cleansing ritual that's rooted in blind tradition. I mean, it really takes you by surprise. I love that story. Mm-hmm. So in addition to King and Jackson, other Gothic writers today that we might think of are Anne Rice or Peter Straub, Joyce Carol Oates' Belle Fleur from 1980, Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, Dennis Lehane's Shutter Island, a favorite of mine, Elizabeth Kostova's The Historian, which is a vampire tale, and then perhaps Deborah Harkness's All Souls trilogy. I think her new one just came out this summer. So there's all kinds of terror and horror films. I have to say that for me, the 1978 film of Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis Donald Pleasance is still by far my favorite. It still terrifies me. And I love to watch it like all Gothic fans and be scared.
Right, yeah. And it still has some of those, you know, sort of classic elements you talked about before, like the virginal maiden, the family drama, the
madness.
Sort of, you know,
Exactly.
great and very, very timely. How does the Gothic appear in your classes that you teach? And what are some of your favorite works to teach?
Okay, so yes, Gothic works always make themselves into my classroom. And I teach Gothic lit usually within the context of the period in which it was written. I try to discourage the Gothic from only being seen as sort of a hackneyed story of the long ago and far away. My main two Gothic texts that you'll find usually in my classes are Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Bram Stoker's Dracula. While both of these novels certainly do have elements of terror and horror, I also place them in the contemporary happenings of Romanticism and of Victorianism. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with Frankenstein, we will discuss the vitalist and materialist debates that were at the center of the new science in the early 1800s. With Dracula, we also think about Victorian science and new technologies like the phonograph, the typewriter, and Gregg's shorthand that really come to bear on the hunt for the Count. Right. So while I acknowledge that we find the typical Gothic conventions in both of these works and many others, these writers were also exploring the anxieties of their time, often drawing upon the everyday in creating their stories. There's a contemporary critic, Nina Auerbach, who's written Our Vampires Ourselves.
Yeah.
And in that book, she claims that we make the vampire who we need him to be, depending on whatever is the greatest angst. And so I see that as happening. They really try to root it in the terms of their day and their happenings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I think, making the distinction, too, between, Gothic literature that's complex and takes into account all of these different things rather than, like you were saying, some things that just shock or just, titillate or whatever, and I think we can see those divisions even today in contemporary literature, things that are doing that well and things that are,
not so well.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yes.
So could you say a few words about your career path? I mean, how did you arrive at British literature?
Well, I was a student of Ed Wilson's as an undergraduate here at Wake Forest, and that may be enough to be said.
Right.
Just on that. After taking his British Romantic Poets course, I was really hooked. I was fascinated by the writers and the works of this era, and as many will say who have studied under him, hearing Dr. Wilson read Romantic poetry aloud is like hearing music. I knew I wanted to find a career where I could teach, read, and write about literature. So after graduating from Wake Forest, I spent a year getting my master's degree at the University of Durham in England and took two especially memorable courses, landscape and literature, and one on Milton and the Romantics. So especially drawn to the intersections of painting and poetry, this course then prompted me to pursue a much more interdisciplinary approach to the period. And while getting my PhD at the University of Georgia, I was surrounded by an amazing group of women faculty that got me interested in the Gothic and women's and gender studies, which has led to more research and teaching interest in gender, genre, and history. I had the chance to visit Tintern Abbey in Wales 2 years ago, and Although I did not take the candlelight tour, which I wanted to take, it was a stunning Gothic ruin to behold. So yeah. I'm excited to see where these interests will take me next.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What are you working on right now?
So right now I do have a book project in the works. It's called Romantic Compositions, A Poetics of Home and Exile in Women's Writing from 1790 to 1832. And so it's looking at these very hybrid generic texts written by women writers across the span of the Romantic period and how this hybridity really affected the way they portrayed home and exile, particularly how I think, and here's the Gothic in me coming out, particularly how they seem to foreground experiences of the Unheimlich in their experiences of both home and exile. And so I range from Helen Mirai Williams, Mary Wollstonecraft, Mary Shelley, of course, Jane Austen, Felicia Hemans, Letitia Elizabeth Landon, and Dorothy Wordsworth. So it's a whole coterie of work, so that's kind of my primary focus right now.
I really enjoyed talking with you today. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Way on Gothic Literature. You can listen to other episodes of Humanities Viewpoints on the Humanities Institute website, humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/podcast, or listen to us for free on iTunes. Just visit the podcast section of the iTunes store and search for Humanities Viewpoints. Humanities Viewpoints is recorded and produced by me, program coordinator Amy Meppam. Happy Halloween, and thanks for listening.